Fox for the Hero Center for Practical Ethics, and we're pleased to welcome you to this special event. It is hosted by Sophia Ingram for Oxford and the Oxford Hero Center for Practical Ethics. We have a very distinguished speaker today, Professor Ronald Cole Turner, H. Parker Sharp Chair in Theology and Ethics at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Is a well-renowned expert on religious implications of emerging technologies and the potential for human modification. One of the founders and former vice president of the International Society for Science and Religion, author of many publications, of which the most recent is the edited collection Design and Destiny, Jewish and Christian Perspective on Human Journal and Modification. And he has a very interesting title for this evening, Human Enhancement in Christianity, a Case of Friendly Fire, and following the talk there will be a discussion with a panel of people from very diverse backgrounds, which should be quite interesting. And the chair of this event this evening is Dr. Margaret Keith from Sofia. We welcome you.
Thank you very much, Guy, for coming and through us being able jointly to hold this event. For us, it is a first in Oxford that the three units of Sofia Europa Oxford, the UHERO Centre, and the director of the McDonald Centre should be here. And we trust that this evening's exchange will bring productive ends of a historic level for the future, because things like that that often begin in Oxford have come to great advancement. And as Dr. Kahane has indicated, the four panel members will raise questions at the close of Professor Ronald Cole Turner's address, and we trust that that exchange between disciplines and between critical thought will prove most productive. And therefore, at this moment, we would enjoy listening to Professor Ronald Cole Turner and look forward very much to this address that he will provide for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, all of you who are here, and those of you who have worked so hard to plan for this evening. In fairness, it must be said right at the outset that the discussion about the development and use of the technologies of human enhancement is perhaps centered nowhere so much as right here at this university. I want to invite you to think through that debate about human enhancement in relation to religion, specifically in relationship, of course, to Christianity. My purpose in doing so is in part motivated by the appeals that are sometimes made to religion as an obstacle to the development of these technologies, as if the critics of the development of these technologies found in religion some sort of a bioconservative ally. When I read the enhancement debate as a Christian theologian, I am not convinced that Christianity will prove to be a very reliable ally for anti-enhancement forces, if an ally at all. In fact, I see a far more complicated picture, one which positions Christianity on the pro-enhancement side, but of course with certain dissimilarities between the Christian position and the secular position, dissimilarities and therefore to be expected rivalries, and these rivalries might be thought to flare up from time to time, and certainly they have and will. And so I suggest, therefore, the metaphor of friendly fire rather than direct conflict. I want to begin by listing nine traits or aspects of human beings that either are or might be, might sometime prove to be, enhanceable. And before reading the list, I want to make it clear, everything on the list has been suggested by at least someone as a trait that might be enhanced. Whether it is, or whether it ever will be, in fact, enhanceable, by gene modification, by some sort of stem cell intervention, by some implant or pharmaceutical product, or perhaps by surgery, is in most cases still an open question. One that I think deserves debate, but not one in which I intend to offer an opinion. In other words, by including a particular trait on this list, I am not suggesting that the technology now exists, or even that it will ever exist, to enhance the trait in a straightforward way. The state of technology now and in the future is, as I suggest, for others to debate. The nine traits I have in mind are these. First, appearance, which may be enhanced by cosmetic surgery or perhaps by a whole host of cosmetic products. Second, athleticism, which of course is enhanced by conventional training, but also by performance-enhancing drugs. Third, sexual function, about which I think very little needs to be said, except that you should be most grateful that you don't have to sit through American television and the constant barrage of television commercials advocating sexual performance-enhancing drugs. Fourth, general health, including heightened resistance to disease. Fifth, cognitive ability, perhaps through use of off-label use of memory-improving drugs developed perhaps in the first instance for dementia patients or perhaps through your use of caffeine. Sixth, lifespan, or as some say, health span extension, the duration of our healthy years, including the attempt to slow down, perhaps even to stop the aging process. Seventh, mood, understood as the psychological states of anxiety or depression, or more precisely in this case, the use of drugs designed to treat depression to elevate the mood, as some have said, to a state better than well. Eighth, and moving ever more into the area of speculation, moral predispositions, so that a tendency toward empathy or compassion or courage might somehow be upregulated. And ninth, states of spiritual awareness, a warm sense of cosmic belonging perhaps, or connection, preferably without the side effects of hallucinogenic drugs. Now, some of these are at present purely speculation. Some are widely practiced. Some may be achievable by one technology, some by another. My own view is that we will, step by step, gain the power to enhance at least the first seven traits on this list, even beyond our present powers, but that advances will be largely incremental and will therefore be accepted by society as a gradual accommodation to a new situation. When we begin to compare this list and the whole of the enhancement project to Christianity, we're struck first by a sharp dissimilarity. For traditional Christianity, the human estate begins high, falls quite low, but regains what is lost. The secular enhancement project does not imagine a primordial, lofty state. Of course, contemporary Christianity, having taken account first to the mythic quality of biblical literature and then to the theory of evolution, does not regard that primordial state so much as a literal episode in our natural history as a species, but rather as a mythic narrative framework in which contemporary theological themes are given a rich tapestry, if you will, of meanings. Even without a literal primordial state, Christianity still speaks of restoration, redemption, reconciliation, and renewal. The use of the prefix RE is widespread at the very heart of Christianity. Nowhere more so than in the naming of the central figure, Jesus Christ, as the Redeemer. Consider now a second list of human traits. This time, traits possessed, according to traditional Christian literature, possessed by Adam and Eve in their primordial state. First, an unmediated spiritual connection or fellowship with God. Second, moral innocence and virtue. Third, bliss. Fourth, perpetual youth. Fifth, encyclopedic knowledge of nature, though perhaps not of good and evil. Sixth, perpetual health. Now, the unusually astute listener might be on to me at this point, for although my list of the six primordial traits of Adam and Eve comes from classic Christian theology, it also parallels exactly my previous list of enhanceable traits, minus the first three. And, to make it more demanding on you, I inverted the order of the remaining four through nine, but the same six traits in inverted order. My point is not simply that there is a similarity here, but to ask whether, for Christian theology, reverting to the primordial state is enhancement at all. Precisely because traditional theology includes such a primordial state, it cannot very well be said that a return to the original condition is enhancement, least of all if enhancement is code language for the immoral. If you will permit me one final list, according to Christianity, the present or fallen state, the only state that we know, the present or fallen state of human beings is characterized by these traits. First, alienation from God. Second, moral confusion, to put it mildly. Thirdly, absence of bliss, or perhaps you could read that as anxiety or depression. Fourth, fading youth, to use the language of the Renaissance poets. Fifth, limited, sharply limited, I would say, knowledge. And sixth, frequent illness. These traits or characteristics of human life as we know it, according to traditional Christianity, are not the way God created us or intends us to be, but are a fallen nature, a second nature, that phrase coming from early Christian sources, a second nature, from which we shall be in due course set free. I want to elaborate a little further by noting three points. First of all, while the loss of the primordial traits is largely an abrupt change, that is to say, when Adam and Eve fall, they cataclysmically lose those traits, it is not entirely so. In some respects, it is a loss by degrees. In the mythic language of the book of Genesis, even after the unending lifespans of Adam and Eve have been lost, their immediate descendants, through about 10 generations, managed to live hundreds of years, with the Methuselah, of course, taking the longevity prize at 969 years. Second, just as the loss of the primordial traits is by degrees, so is their regain. While the greatest transformation occurs at the end of time in Christian understanding, with the resurrection, the restoration of the primordial traits begins even now, at least for the saints. It is not just Jesus, but some other saints who exhibit power over nature, for instance, exhibited by the power of healing, or experienced heightened moral and spiritual states of awareness. Consider the example of Anthony of Egypt, who fasted in order to bring himself closer to God and, as he understood it, closer to the primordial condition of Adam and Eve, and in so doing became perhaps the first to experiment with caloric reduction, alarming his friends, but surviving, seemingly without aging, until his death after 100 years. What is notable is that his life and that of other saints becomes not an oddity so much as a prototype for the whole church, for the fullest possible expression of the meaning of the Christian life. Third, the loss of the primordial traits is not without some gifts that allow for their remediation. In other words, according to traditional Christian theology, God does not leave us weakened by the loss, by this loss, without some means of regaining in part what has been lost. Earlier I said 3 points, I misread, and I meant to say these points, so continuing my list beyond three, onto the fourth of these points. Fourth, the regaining of the primordial traits is by grace, but it's also by human effort. Indeed, on one reading of Christianity, grace and works are so commingled as to be inseparable. All is grace and all is human achievement. Fifth, and perhaps most controversially, what is gained in the end, according to Christian theology, is more than a mere reinstatement of the original condition. In Christ, in other words, the human is elevated to a state higher than Adam and Eve, enhanced, if you will, to a wholly new plane. Now, with these points in mind, I want to pose three questions that arise for me as a theologian as I go about reading the enhancement discussion. First, when someone advocates for human enhancement, what is it exactly that they mean to enhance? Is it to enhance a trait? To enhance a person? To enhance the human species? Or to enhance evolution? I find all four in the literature, sometimes in a single sentence. Or, for instance, there is a recent book entitled Enhancing Evolution, and I searched in vain for a discussion of evolution, and it seems to me that the author says what we are to enhance are persons or human lives, but almost nothing, in fact, if I'm reading correctly, nothing about enhancing evolution, which I take it to be quite a different project. The answer to my first, to my question, enhance what, I think is probably best given when we say enhance persons or enhance human lives. That is what should be enhanced. That seems to me to be the most straightforward. But of the four options, theology, I think, leaves itself in search for yet another. And so theology, let me suggest, might answer with a fifth option, answer this enhance what question. Enhance the creation, I think, would be theology's answer. Enhance the creation, in particular the human creature, so that it more fully expresses the full intentions of the Creator. Quite a different answer, but maybe not wholly incompatible. Second, another question that occurs to me as I read the enhancement literature is to ask, if it is the person that is enhanced, and the person is subsequently profoundly changed, perhaps over a lifespan which itself is enhanced to stretch for maybe hundreds of years, is the person actually enhanced or replaced? In some corners, this is known as the question of authenticity. If I am enhanced, am I still the same person? All of which drives us, I think, to a more episodic as opposed to an essentialist view of what it means to be a person, a succession of conditions that are somehow tied together, but which appear to be a succession of persons. Theology, I suggest, is no stranger to this problem. I don't think that theology's answer is particularly satisfying, and I'm not sure that it will help us with the secular authenticity debate. But one of the earliest and most influential converts to Christianity sets the stage for the Christian version of the question of authenticity by his very name change. Paul was originally Saul, but that person is effectively negated and transformed into someone else almost altogether. The old identity, as he describes it, is replaced with what Paul then refers to as the Christ in him. Now, I think this problem is not entirely solved in Christianity, the problem of the question of identity of the person through transformation, but the old self is replaced for Paul by a new self, and the bridging from one state of the self to the next is by the category of Christ in the life of the believer, the presence of the Christ. To quote the Apostle Paul, "I have been crucified with Christ." Talk about the negation of the old self. "I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me." The continuity, the factor of continuity here, is found in the Christ identity, which carries the human person through its changes over time. Again, I want to suggest that the Christian solution is problematic in its own right and wholly incompatible, I think, with any secular possibility of a solution. But the parallel is absolutely striking, that we have had for 2,000 years a version of this authenticity problem. Which self am I, really? Third, some who argue for enhancement, even to the point of replacing the human species with something else, might fairly be called transhumanists. Theology, in my opinion, should have no particular theological objection. There might be other objections that theologians might share, but no particular theological objection to the idea that not only is the individual self replaced by a series of future episodic selves, but that the human species is replaced by a transcendent post-human form of humanity. After all, for theology, the creation and its future are not ours, either to protect or to modify, either to create or to refuse to create. In conclusion, let me suggest just these final thoughts. I think it is fair to say that the challenges posed by the technologies of human enhancement might drive religion further to the margins of the contemporary world, made even less relevant than, let's say, the challenges of science, because technology is not merely conceptual, but actually delivers the goods. Technology is now increasingly able to deliver what religion long promised, but has so far largely failed to deliver. Trust in technology is already replacing trust in God. But there is, I think, an alternative scenario for the future, not one in which religion is pushed further off into the margins, but one in which religion, and I hope Christianity in particular, might do yet again what it does and has done so well in the past, to take stock of its new situation, to find affinities with our scientific and technological age, to clarify the points of engagement, to find the right balance between criticism and accommodation. And if so, then, of course, there will be moments of exchange, as I suggest, of friendly fire between the advocates of enhancement and the advocates of a contemporary faith. The big question, of course, for theology is to ask itself whether it is prepared to say that the Creator is creating still, that human lives might yet be created in new forms, and possibly even transhuman lives, through the means of emerging powers of technology. In that case, these technologies are new powers in the hands of the Creator. For theology, I see no alternative but to claim that to be true. But I wonder if the secular advocates of enhancement are willing to allow theology to get away with that. Thank you.
Could I now ask our panel members to come forward, because we've had a number of very interesting questions raised for us, and I think we need to hear from a diversity of thinkers. So we have here coming forward for us, first of all, Dr. Cahane himself from the UHERO Centre, whose area of research has been in value theory, metaphysics, practical ethics, and the history of ethics, and the philosophy of ethics of neuroscience. We also have Professor Nigel Bigger, who is Regius Professor here of Moral and Pastoral Theology and the Director of the new MacDonald Centre for Theology, Ethics and Public Life. Welcome, Nigel, amongst us. Dr. Anders Sandberg from the Oxford UHERO Centre, who himself is involved with computational neurosciences and particularly interested in enhancing human cognition and the ethics of politics of emerging technologies, so right in that arena. And then Dr. Petros Ligoxigarkas, who is the lecturer in genetics in the Department of Biochemistry and will have some interesting contribution, I know, to make for us. We wish, first of all, that the panel should give some response to the questions raised, be in discussion with Professor Cole Turner, and then we would like to have a moment too to open to questions from the floor. So, is there a burning member in any question for those who are, perhaps it should, is it a bit unfair for me to either ask the two members of the UHERO Centre who might like to respond?
The transhumanist side, well, should speak first.
That last question as to whether you agree with him or not.
I think I agree quite a lot, actually. I'm very much reminded, though, actually, it's probably the first philosopher I really seriously read anything of, and that is Taylor de Chardin, who is, for those who know about him, he was a somewhat heretical Catholic theologian. He tried to unite his Christian faith with paleontology, and he ended up with a very interesting theology, essentially arguing that mankind, thanks to its new technologies, is becoming ever more interconnected, and together with spiritual refinement, eventually the new sphere, the sphere of consciousness, would become all united. We would essentially become a kind of group mind, which would be the manifestation and unity between mankind and God. That a lot of more conservative theologians didn't take very kindly to that idea. I encountered that in a very interesting book, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle by Barrow and Tipler. And Tipler later on took this even further, essentially created a kind of physical eschatology that led to the development of what can only be described as a physicist version of God at the end of time. It's probably the only theological theory that ends up predicting the mass of the Higgs boson, and actually being disproven by physical experiments. So I think that there is a lot of connections here, both in terms of the idea that, yes, we can become better. There is some level of perfect ability in mankind. And I think there is a lot of interest in these questions in transhumanist communities, although there are relatively few would be traditional Christians, I think. It's very notable that the Mormon Transhumanist Association is the fastest growing transhumanist organization right now. And they, of course, have a very dynamic view of God. They have an idea that God is indeed very much changing and developing. So I think there is a lot of connections here.
Now, Professor, you don't want to respond immediately. You'd like to hear some comments, or would you like to respond?
I actually thought each one was going to speak for a period of time,
but this may be much more effective.
Maybe it'd be better for me to respond as we go along. But you're quite right in pointing to Teilhard de Chardin, and you're quite right that he was badly treated by the church, and that process is still in the working out of a kind of rehabilitation. He was also badly treated among scientists because he was implicated, especially in the writings of Stephen Jay Gould, in the Piltdown hoax. And I don't think anybody believes he really intended to defraud, but he was a largely misunderstood figure, and for that reason, I think, all the more exciting. Because he really did imagine that radio communications, which he did live to see, and even television, would evolve eventually into higher forms of global electronic communications. And some have accredited him as being one of the first to envision something like the Internet, a really remarkable thing for a paleoanthropologist slash priest to do. He also had a capacity to talk about a purpose in creation, as if there's a destiny that lies ahead. And that was his Christianity, of course, at play that allowed him to suggest that. And I find that I want to be sympathetic with that, but I also want to be extremely cautious about making any such claims, because it seems to me that is also a scientific question, a question of evolutionary biology. So one might read, for instance, Simon Conway Morris in the context of that discussion, but one would have to pursue that, I think, with a great deal of care. Is there a purpose in the evolutionary process? And if you were to take the point of view that the purpose of enhancement is to enhance evolution, then you'd have to have in mind some goal, some purpose, which you are consciously enhancing. Theologically, I come close to that, but I want to tie it more to a theological expectation rather than one that arises strictly out of the sciences, although I don't want to, again, bifurcate unnecessarily. Now, you mentioned, was it the Mormon transhumanists?
Yes.
Yes, very, very interesting group. The Mormons are, I'm sure they're not any stranger here to you in England, but they're very widely established in the United States, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they are among the groups that believe, in their more traditional form, that the end is near and it is going to come in rather dramatic form. And they see a direct affinity between that and the singularity as postulated by Ray Kurzweil and some others. This point of transition where things just sort of run away with us, and we're sort of swept along by, in the case of the technologists, by forces that we've created, in the case of the Mormon, by forces that are entirely at the hand of God. But in the end, they make a move that I hinted at the end. If it is technology that emerges from within the creation, who is to say that it is not then within this larger theological context? And so they make that kind of a move, but they invoke this notion of a singularity with which I suppose I have some reservations. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Dee, would you like to make response to the address now at this point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you talk about friendly fire, friendly fire can still be fatal. So I'd like David to ask you to clarify a few things. Mm-hmm. If you look at the enhancement debate, there is in a sense a debate between a very continuation of a very old debate between progressivists of certain kind and conservatives of certain kind. And it's, I suppose, there's something in common between those who push for enhancement or even radical form and traditional religion, so in Christianity, seeing the current human condition as pretty bad. If you thought it's pretty good, could be made a bit better, but there are all these dangers, then we can just not go into that. But if you thought the starting point is pretty unimpressive, your thought about transforming humans, or even in radical ways, would be very different. So there's one commonality here, I think. But as I read the debate, one key issue, both by religious or quasi-religious critics of enhancement, and even secular critics, is a sort of concern about attitudes, for to start with, that are involved in seeking enhancement or seeking radical transformation, and then about the means through which that is achieved. And that's some, these two points we didn't really say much about. So people like Michael Sandel, who appeal to, don't present himself explicitly as religious, but are critics of enhancement that draw on quasi-religious ideas, make a lot of this idea of humility that seems to be incompatible, they think, with seeking to transform yourself and make yourself better in all sorts of grand ways. Yep. They think enhancement or seeking enhancement expresses some kind of morally distorted or perverted attitude that might even be theologically perverted. And then there's this issue about means. So one thing you didn't mention in your list is suffering. So ending all suffering can be an aim of enhancement, but you might think from a Christian point of view that's a problematic aim. And there's this idea of, well, maybe we agree that we should reach certain goal improvements, but how you get there is supposed to matter. And for a lot of proponents of enhancement, you know, as long as you're not doing something morally wrong, like harming people or whatever, then it's fine, that's the way to go, as long as the outcome is good. But a lot of the critics think, well, if you become better, gave example of saying, so, well, something maybe should be bestowed on you because you deserve it, or maybe you've had to go through a valley of suffering to get there. But the enhancement, pro-enhancement people are transmitting to think, yeah, well, they can have a shortcut directly there. So I wonder what you think about that aspect of the debate. You didn't really enter into.
Yeah, that's quite helpful. There is a range of attitudes, I think, within Christianity about suffering. I suppose most Christians would agree that one can learn and grow through the pathway of suffering. And if that's the case, then starting out on the pathway, the main question that should be asked is, how can I learn and how can I grow, not how can I stop this suffering? That's not to say that that suffering is not to be treated, and particularly it's not to say that I have any kind of a callous attitude toward the suffering of others. Never would I say, well, I see you suffering, it's good for you to suffer, you're going to grow in your suffering, so I'm just going to leave you in your suffering. And that's an attitude that I don't think you would ever find articulated in a Christian position. But it's a recognition that if it lies ahead for me as an inevitable future, then I can approach it in at least two ways, as something that is an occasion for growth or something that is utterly destructive. And you're quite right, that is there within Christianity. But again, I don't think that turns into a complacency or a disregard or a disinclination to try to remove it insofar as reasonably possible. I think, if anything, what it amounts to in the end is a recognition that, a certain skepticism, will it ever be possible to remove all suffering? I mean, people seem to be capable of finding new ways to suffer. When you remove one problem, then we worry or are anxious about something else. Now, I suppose you could remove all suffering, but the cost might, in other respects, might be so high that you really would want to wonder about that. And there's nothing peculiar about Christianity that would raise the question of the cost, whether it would mean just the obliteration of the capacity to feel anything emotionally, for instance. But it's a hugely complex complex question. You raised the question of means, and that's an intriguing question, whether an enhanced state achieved the old-fashioned way by hard work, or the enhanced state achieved by some sort of newer technological intervention, or perhaps in the case of athletic performance, maybe a combination of the two. Whether the intrusion of the technology means a loss in the full worth, experience of the enhanced state. And one can certainly make I think, a case that that could be true, and it raises an interesting worry. I don't know that it's a particular worry for Christians as opposed to others. I don't see it as an argument that could possibly shut down the progress toward the development of enhancement technologies. I just don't see it as having that kind of an effect. I think, at the very least, it's a simple reminder that you might want to make one thing easy so that you can go on and do something else that's hard. Or you might want to make two things easy via technology so you can go on to something completely different that's hard. There is a place for challenges, but not everything in life has to be a challenge. So you might enhance technologically and leave it as more of a mixed bag in some other area. But I think that's a problem that anybody thinking about technology of enhancement is going to face. Let's see, you had a third point, and I...
Attitude.
I think you're quite right. More should have been said on that. And in fact, I've just finished off an essay in which I raised this in reference to extension of lifespan. And what I argue, in essence, is that there's nothing that I see intrinsic in Christianity which forces a Christian to refuse to extend his or her lifespan. But at the same time, for the Christian, it's not that I might live longer, I, this selfish being that I am, but rather first, I must go through a pathway of renouncing that self, renouncing that selfishness in particular. And if it's good then for me to live longer so that I might be of service to others, then I think Christianity or Christians may legitimately go that route. Now, some Christians will look at me and say, oh, well, you've become a Buddhist. And to some extent, that is a bit more of a... That's a theme that is, let's say, more richly articulated in other traditions. I think it is also in Christianity, but to be quite honest with you, I think contemporary Christianity is largely as selfish in its expectation as anybody else. Christianity is largely presented as a program of self-enhancement. Become a Christian and it will make you a better self. I mean, the most obscene form of that is one of our television evangelists who basically proclaims Christianity as a formula for becoming your best self, he puts it. Right? It's all about a program of enhancement. And what he fails to see is precisely this little aura of Buddhism right in the heart of the Gospels. Right on the words of Jesus, that we have to go into this pathway by renouncing or by giving up not the identity that I am, but the selfishness that is absorbed with that identity and seeks to preserve it. And to the extent that perhaps some transhumanists, some advocates of enhancement begin to sound excessively selfish, yes, there'll be some Christians who might want to take that on and say that is a point of conflict.
It's actually an interesting point that in a survey of the World Transhumanist Association, the religion of the members, agnostic and atheists were, of course, the majority. The second largest religion was Buddhism.
Yes, right. Very interesting.
I think this is fitting now that Professor Bigger should give us some thought on these reflections.
Okay. My thoughts really took off from a very early statement that Professor Coltella made. You said something like Christianity, in your view, is pro-enhancement. Something like that. Well, my initial thought is, well, in the circles I move, that would be an unusual position. But maybe it so happens I move in more conservative circles. So one often hears in Christian circles or reads in Christian reflections on these matters complaints about enhancement as being in some sense unnatural or worries about it involving playing God. Now, in my own view, having considered the kinds of conservative arguments that arise out of those concerns, those arguments just don't work. And actually, here I converge with our speaker. It seems to me that it belongs to human dignity that human being is the kind of being precisely who is capable of transcending what's given, creating, recreating, innovating, And right back in the very first, the opening chapters of the sacred texts of Jews and Christians and even Muslims, the book of Genesis, we have the story of God Almighty creating man in his own image. And as I read that story, it is precisely a story of a delegation of authority and power by God to the human creature to manage, creatively, creation. So contrary to the kind of Nietzschean vision of God as a kind of power-jealous tyrant who wants to keep humanity in servility, it is the opposite. It is God who is devolving power and authority to creation. So it seems to me that taking our cue from there, a Christian has to be in favour of improvement. I mean, you know, who can be against it? But can I agree with you when you say Christianity is or should be pro-enhancement? Well, yes and no, or at least yes with a qualification. And here's my qualification. If the enhancement is a real benefit that is prudent and just, a real benefit that is prudent and just. So if we're going to have objections to enhancement, it's not the objection that it's unnatural, right. It's got to be an objection that is immoral. Yes. Okay. Let me just give you an example of how I think an enhancement might be immoral, just to unpack what I mean by saying it's got to be a real benefit, for example. So I should make clear I'm not an expert in this particular field, but I have heard people talking in this university about enhancement and talking in particular about enhancing what you call cognitive ability or IQ, or enhancing appearance, making people more beautiful, so, you know, blonde and blue eyes, or enhancing their athletic prowess. Now, whilst I don't want to say that any of those qualities, high IQ, beauty, or athletic prowess, I don't want to say that they're bad, they're not evil, but I think I want to say that they are only ambiguously good. In this respect, none of them amount to or cause either virtue or wisdom. None of them amount to or cause necessarily happiness. None of them amount to or cause necessarily social welfare. And on this last point, as I was walking here, it occurred to me to say, it has been pointed out to us that the current financial crisis in which we are now involved can be attributed to the creation of enormously complex financial instruments by our brightest and our best. High IQ is no guarantee of a better world. Okay. High IQ that is virtuous and wise is, but until we get to the place of enhancing virtue and wisdom, and I guess your eighth form of enhancement suggests that some think we can, I would need a lot of persuading. So I'm raising just a sceptical question about how enhancing enhancement really is. Now, the answer to the question depends on what we're talking about, but there's a question hanging there. I think Guy mentioned Michael Sandel. Just to say, it's not just religious people who have moral reservations. I mean, Guy mentioned Sandel. There's also Jürgen Habermas, who has reservations on Kantian grounds. Okay. Yes. I mean, I mentioned also that there's also the possibility that enhancement might be imprudent in the sense that, okay, so here's something that might really be able to enhance. But we're so determined to enhance this that we will simply downplay or shift out of the equation altogether all sorts of ill side effects that might arise. Or we create some spurious utilitarian calculation that rationalizes what we're determined to do. Now, I'm not saying that necessarily happens, but even if we agree that enhancement would be worthwhile, there's a question of whether it's prudent, given all the other things that might arise in the process of bringing it about. So, am I pro-enhancement, or do I think Christians should be pro-enhancement? Yes, if it's a real enhancement, a real benefit, that's prudent and just. So, a qualified agreement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit disappointed so far because it seemed like almost total agreement. It's a bit worrying. But maybe we'll find some disagreements later on.
Yes,
Do you wish to respond to that, Professor, at this point?
You go first.
Well, I mean, in the spirit of agreement, I like very much the way you put it about the relative poverty of this rhetoric of playing God, and particularly I like the phrase devolving power. I think that nicely captures sort of a new approach in Christianity to understand the nature of the divine. We might bat around a bit this question of whether a particular enhancement is of real benefit, and you had, I think, several ways of putting it, but particularly prudent and just, or that it contributes to greater happiness or social good, all of which is a criteria-related language for what counts then as a real enhancement as opposed to a modification that might bump up the score on a particular measurable trait, but bumps it up. Well, here's where we get to the question of what is it that we mean to enhance? Do we mean to enhance traits, or do we mean to enhance persons? And I think if we're faced with a choice between enhancing traits, enhancing persons, enhancing the species, the human species, or enhancing evolution, whatever that is, I think the most plausible is to say enhancing persons, and that would be my way of getting at this question of prudent. If I'm an individual and I'm my muscle mass is enhanced, that might be a good thing up to a certain point, provided it's done, let's say, through exercise preferably, or maybe through a proven safe drug. In other words, let's simply rule out side effects. Suppose we have a completely safe drug that could actually help build muscle mass. That might be a good thing, but only up to a point, even though you could perhaps increase beyond that point, and you could say, well, we're still enhancing that trait, and we're making you more athletic. That would not be good for me as a person. So I think you always have to back up and ask what is good for the person as a whole. And I think it's precisely at that point that the question of prudence cuts in. And I quite agree then that apart from any theological criteria, the only reliable judge of what is a prudent enhancement or an authentic enhancement is the individual who would seek to be enhanced. Would I have a better life if this change were made via technology with a reasonable expectation of avoiding side effects, etc.? And I think only the individual can say where that is. To which then I would add an additional theological point, but maybe in the spirit now of crossfire among those who are supposedly in the same camp, let me push you a bit. Is there a theological criterion that comes into play that helps illuminate even further beyond what I've given, as I think perfectly workable in the secular setting? Is there a theological criterion? I suggested one very quickly in passing toward the end, that is, what technology should seek to enhance is the creation, and particularly the human, so that it more fully represents the full intentions of the Creator. Now, I'm glad nobody's asking me to spell that out in a precise blueprint, because I certainly don't mean to claim that I can read the mind of the Creator. But asking that question as a heuristic device means that I have yet another question to ask beyond, would I like this improvement for myself? I have yet another question. Is this, if I were a Christian seeking technologies of enhancement, I would ask not simply, does this give me a better life, but is this a life more fully in accord with what I believe to be God's purposes in creating me? So it's just one additional question, but it is a theological question. And I'm wondering if in your thought there is a theological criterion that must be met to separate purported enhancement from authentic enhancement?
Off the top of my head. I'm not sure I can answer you head on there. My concern at the moment rests at the point of, a drive to enhance that rides roughshod over questions of prudence. That's to say, there may be certain benefits that we could achieve, but our drive to achieve them is so great that we simply neglect to take into account all the side disbenefits that call into question whether this achievement is a real achievement, all things considered. So it's just imprudent.
Yes.
That's all I can think of.
I think on that we are quite agreed that, to the extent possible, the kind of conversation we have here ought to translate out into the broader culture, not through legislation, but through a consciousness that says to people, do you really want to increase muscle mass indefinitely? Do you really want to increase this or that or the other? In other words, an education of prudence, of the judgment of the potential consumers of these technologies of enhancement. Fortunately, in most categories, we have a lot of time. But in some categories, I think it might safely be said people are doing imprudent things. Relatively young athletes in the United States.
And could I just, at this point now, I think as we get into the specifics of the debate and the ones that apply not only to theologians and their concerns for the human creature, but also the technological people involved as to which trades they will advance and in which ways, I think this is the point where our geneticists might have some valuable input for us. And so I'll ask them.
Yes, well, I probably should start with an apology, which is not a good way to start, but because I will kind of land our plane into the ground rather than, you know, keep it in the philosophical sphere. Starting from the list of, you know, human enhancement, then, right, you know, I understand the point that you're not debating whether this is possible or not, but let me just say your last point that we have a lot of time to discuss this. We have very, you know, much time to discuss because we are, you know, way off of, you know, even proving that there is some kind of... I'm a geneticist, but I would be the first to say that, you know, not everything is dependent on our genes. There might be a genetic component in many of the things we are and do, but, you know, it's, I don't think that necessarily, you know, there is enhancement in terms of genetics in everything in the list. And you said, of course, you know, that it's not necessarily going to be genetic, but also pharmaceutical and so on. I mean, the thing that I wanted to kind of say, as somebody that has a research group that works in genetics and you know, discussing with my students and my postdocs and people, and you know, I want to say something about what you say, that whether we want to enhance people, persons, or traits, or evolution. Then, as the situation is on the ground now, meaning, you know, as research is going now, it is very difficult to distinguish between these things. And actually, I mean, I will give you an example. That actually was in the newspapers not so long ago. So that was the first, at least in Britain, I think, the first case of pre-implantation genetic screening. So that was So there was a couple that wanted to have a baby with IVF, and the father was a carrier of a gene that if the gene was passed on to the baby, and if the baby was female, that would be giving 50 to 70% possibilities for this baby to develop ovarian or breast cancer in their, you know, 30s or 40s, and stuff like that. So the couple decided to go through genetic screening, pick up the mutation, and eliminate all the IVF embryos that had the mutation, and then decide to implant the embryo that didn't have the mutation. So in that sense, I mean, as enhancement, as a geneticist now in 2009, I always feel that enhancement has to do with preventing disease rather than, you know, being clever, beautiful, or whatever. But let's imagine the possibility, which is a very distinct possibility and very real possibility, that this becomes a test that is permitted, right, through, and it can be given through NHS or whatever, to the National Health Service. So that means that you will be able to have children that will grow up, be young people, and, you know, give their own progeny and everything, that will not have a mutation of this gene. And therefore, you're going to have a whole population of these people that is not only a husband of persons, it's a husband of a trait, because you are working against ovarian and breast cancer. And at the same time, you're working for enhancement of the humans, you know, the evolution of the human species, in a sense. Well, you're engineering, you're not working. I mean, I'm not saying that not having this gene we're going to be better, I mean, because I don't know what better is in terms of genetics. But you're going to have engineered the evolution of the human species, which you would have wiped out. I mean, if this test will be, you know, worldwide used, you're going to have people that will not have this mutation, right? So if you kind of extrapolate this to other kinds of traits and other kinds of genes and other kinds of diseases, so it's very difficult to distinguish between people traits and evolution. This is what I'm saying. And evolution does exist we don't see it now. We're not going to see it in 10 years or 20 years, but, if somebody comes after a century of these kind of tests, right, the genetic profile of a certain population will be different than genetic profile in 2009.
Well, I quite agree that the role of genetics, at least up to the present, is quite limited. I mean, somatic cell gene therapy is... there's some tantalizing movement forward, but it's not anything close to what was predicted maybe 20 years ago. Germline is interesting, but you're quite right to point out PGD is the area at the moment. And even before you began to talk about the selection for lower likelihood of cancer, I was already beginning to think along those lines as an example of the kind of thing that is being done using genetics. I think what lies ahead could be very interesting. It might be good to get your opinion on this. But with the advances in stem cell technology, particularly induced pluripotency and the ability of researchers already now for several years to be able to do what in the popular terminology is targeted a gene recombination, it's possible to take pluripotent stem cells, modify their DNA, and quite possibly, some controversy on this, but possibly then to drive forward the differentiation of that cell culture once it's purified for success in taking up the gene modification that was intended, to drive that forward so that it becomes, let's say, sperm precursor cells, and generate actual human sperm that then could be used in a gene modification scenario, and the result then could be not just PGD, selecting from among embryos, but actually creating an embryo with an intended modification. Again, that is clearly going to take a while to work out, but the development of stem cell biology has been remarkably fast, so it may come within a matter of decades, possibly less, but maybe in a matter of that period of time, in which case we really will be opening up some additional possibilities. Still, whether one can ever imagine going in and modifying DNA to enhance something is, I would quite agree, that's going to be a huge challenge. And I think people in your field do debate as to whether some of that might be possible. Will we ever learn how to modify the DNA that is inherited by a future individual that sort of that may upregulate or perhaps even add a gene that makes the result more intelligent? I think you're quite right to question whether that will ever be possible. Converting or switching now from genetics, similar things are already in the pipeline. I mean, Aricept is the way the anti Alzheimer's drug is marketed in the U.S. I don't know if it has a different name here, but it is used by people who are far too young and far too bright to exhibit any evidences of dementia, but they simply want to pass the exam to get into medical school or something like that. And so Aricept and, of course, Ritalin, which is known to boost, I mean, it's a For many people, it's known to boost the performance on a particular test. These drugs are already widely bought and sold and used. Or another example would be, I believe this is factually correct, there's wide government sanctioned use in the U.S. for military pilots for drugs that boost alertness. And, alertness, we don't quite think of that as increasing IQ, but it's certainly in the same family. So in other words, cognitive enhancement, if you're thinking of it as genetic modification that's going to double your IQ, you know, that's not the way science moves. It's as I suggested, tiny steps, incremental steps, and then you look back and you say, well, you know, we've actually taken a fairly big step here, but going forward it looks like smaller steps, and I'm suggesting that these small steps are in fact being taken, but then you get back to the question of whether it is prudent to do so, whether it makes sense to do so, particularly with something as important to all of us in a place like this as intelligence.
And it would seem to me that the question of prudency needs to be defined much more clearly when we're thinking about the human person, and whether we're in technology or whether we're in the humanities. And perhaps this is the moment where we should open the hall to questions from the floor, as we've got just a short time, and you may wish to address them either to Professor Coulton or to members of the panel, having heard them respond to them. Yeah. Yes. Do just mention your background and interest, and then your question.
Okay, I'm a visiting student for the Euro Centre. I'm a visiting student. I come from the University of Bologna as a bioethics. I just want to say that I agree in part with you that if somebody is Christian and believes that human people are made like God and God is perfect, they shouldn't try to improve themselves. But to me, this means that also Christian people, if really true Christians, shouldn't wear glasses or use antibiotics, because this is a kind of betray the trust in God. But apart from this, I don't agree with you when you say that IQ doesn't mean a better life, and being beautiful doesn't mean a better life or chance to be happy, because I think that if someone is really ugly and really stupid, maybe has the 5% of chances to be useful to other people or to be happy. But if somebody is really smart, intelligent, beautiful, maybe this chance will grow. And I don't think you can...
I think you're looking at me, are you? I think all I wanted to say was these qualities are ambiguous. Quite ambiguous. I mean, you can be highly intelligent, very beautiful, and very nasty. That's my. So this is not an unambiguous quality. So I'm simply saying that these. I have no objection to someone being beautiful or intelligent or very healthy. But just know what you're getting, what you're not getting, because each of those qualities can be used for wicked purposes. That's my point. They're not ambiguous goods.
Yes, but ugliness doesn't mean to be good. Maybe, it's just better to be better.
Why is it better to be beautiful?
I think that you're less angry in the world and you don't feel frustrated, for example.
Well, the world might treat you better.
So if you're beautiful, the world treats you better. Yeah.
Well, culturally, they are important factors, aren't they? Yeah, this we do need to enunciate the values. Yeah.
And that teases out another very important theme, whether we sometimes try to modify or enhance traits in order to fit a social expectation, when we really should be addressing the social expectation. But it's not that simple either. I mean, I just came here from a conference of Christian pastors in a fairly conservative part of the United States. One of the conversations that surfaced there was the transformative effect in the congregations of the presence of children with Down syndrome. And I think what they were saying was absolutely true. At the same time, I quite agree. Intelligence is something we value very highly, and if we can increase our intelligence by, first of all, studying very hard and undergoing the disciplines of academic careers, but possibly, if appropriate, considering side effects and other things, cautious use of either caffeine or something a little bit more exotic, why not? I think there was one point that you made that I think we really want to be careful about, and that is increasingly we're saying, well, bright people got us into this present predicament. We ought to be cautious about bright people. Well, maybe it's my vantage point in the United States and the transition from one administration to another, but we now have an administration that has gone on record as not being anti-intellectual. We've just left one that seemed to see anti-intellectualism as a triumph, and that's kind of the mess that we are mopping up over. So I'm particularly keen that we have bright people in positions of critical responsibility. All the more reason to say, well, why not, for the sake of a larger good, be open to the enhancement. But at the same time, you don't want to lose other benefits of human diversity and the peculiar gifts that people bring.
Now, could we have another? We've got several questions.
My name is Michael Burdett. I'm pursuing a graduate degree here in theology, looking at technological eschatologies. You guys seem to all at least be fairly cohesive on kind of the things you guys agree on, and haven't really thrown a kind of wrench into the system. How would you respond to someone like Jacques Ellul, who at the same time as Delphine de Chalons, where relatively came in as the same kind of cultural background, that kind of thing? Would you dismiss him as just a kind of neo-Luddite, or notions of, I don't know, discount him academically, or how would you kind of respond to some of the things that he was really for during his time?
Well, it's a sobering warning, but I just don't find it persuasive. I don't see the evidence. Given his time and place, maybe the evidence looked more compelling to him, but it just doesn't look. And I don't want to be overly naive. I mean, I think great mischief lies ahead. But I think if we have these sorts of conversations and can transform the wider culture with a heightened sense of awareness, we probably will avoid most of what worried him.
Yeah, can I just make a comment on that? It's a long time since I read Ellul, but I do remember concluding that I thought he was just too pessimistic.
Yeah.
However, having said that, I think, and this is partly responding to you again, I mean, I think, there's nothing wrong about wanting to be more beautiful, more strong, more bright. Nothing wrong with that at all. It's just that we shouldn't mistake these things for goodness and wisdom. They're not the same. And that the danger is we will major on becoming more beautiful, more intelligent, more athletic, because these are the things we can change. And we will forget that the really important thing, like wisdom and goodness and love, those can't be created simply by technical means. So we concentrate on the relatively trivial things we can engineer and neglect the more important things that we have to work more hard at. So I'm not objecting to them. It's a question of where the focus is going to be.
Angeliki, and then there's another. Yeah, would you just state your background and interest, and then put your question.
My name is Angeliki Kerasida, and I'm working in bioethics. It's a question to Professor Cole Turner, but if anyone else from the panel would like to answer as well, welcome. Well, you described our current state as a state of alienation, moral confusion and anxiety, and failing youth, and limited knowledge and beliefs. You said that we are looking to enhance ourselves within Christian tradition, at least enhancement and restoration to our previous like remote state that happens between human. It's a combination of human achievement and grace and divine grace. And you also mentioned in the end, especially with your exchange with Professor Bigger, that an extra question is that people who work in enhancement should have, or at least Christians who work in enhancement should have, is whether enhancement is there to also fulfill God's intentions for humankind. And my question is this, why should a Christian trust a science that is not developed by scientists or thinkers that either seek the grace, that they're not Christians, so they don't seek the grace of God, so they're not testing their decisions against that, and they're not testing their decisions against this idea of fulfillment of God's intentions. And should be the case that maybe Christians should have their own laboratories where they do their own enhancement and then why should we trust scientists that they are alienated and morally confused and full of anxiety and with limited knowledge? Yes.
Well, see, I wouldn't trust the Christian scientists either. I mean, it's not a matter of trusting the scientists one way or the other, as if their intentions affect the validity of their science and the reliability of the products they generate, and etc. It's not that I'm not interested in the spiritual, moral state of scientists. I think their findings stand on their own. The point is entirely, it's not about human beings at all. The point is entirely about God, the nature of the divine. God is God and uses all things equally. We could argue this on the basis of scripture interpretation and as well as classical theology, but I think Christians have always said it doesn't matter, the spiritual state of the individual doesn't matter at all as to whether that person can be used by God in a purpose. Now, all other things being equal, it's very nice if that person says, but I really want to be used. I really want to be of service. And I think in that case, there might be more good in the end that comes out of it. But I don't think the refusal or the lack of awareness means that God is somehow blocked from achieving a good through that work.
Probably one of the things that might advance this discussion further too would be to look at the ways in which both insights from spiritual and prudency might be engaged with those who are at the scientific level, in which the conclusion of your address has been to say that you actually affirm that we should better work together and endeavour to find ways in which this can be done in that would enhance human life itself. But we've got some more questions, and I don't want to, from any who...